I go back through his posts, looking for a pattern. He responds more to girls than to guys, particularly to smart girls. He doesn't ever reply to the illiterates or the ranters. He also seems to take an interest in people at the beginning of their journey, the ones who are just starting to think about catching the bus. And he likes philosophy. His posts are full of quotes, and seems drawn to those whose posts are philosophical, too. No wonder he liked Meg. The first step is obvious. I'll have to post something on the boards. An opening, like Meg's. Something that introduces me to the group, announces my intentions to kill myself. Couching those intentions in a question. If I'm too sure, if I'm already shopping for rat poison, I won't seem like a mouse. It takes me several days to come up with something, and then I get stuck thinking of a username. Everything I want to use is related to Meg, and I don't know how much she told him about herself, so I don't want to give myself away. I glance at the overdue stack of library books and use them as inspiration. Kafkaesque, opening salvo. I've been thinking about catching the bus for a while. I think I'm ready to buy my ticket. I just need some encouragement. I'm worried about my family and not succeeding. And let's be honest. Succeeding. I'd welcome intelligent thoughts. As soon as I post it, I regret it. It sounds fake. Nothing like me. And nothing like a suicidal person. I fully expect to be called out as a fraud by everyone on the boards. But the next day, there are several responses. As with Meg, most of them are so nice and encouraging. Welcome. Congratulations. Which, in an odd way, is gratifying. Except all underscore BS isn't among the responders. I might have fooled some of these people, but not the one I'm looking for. I switch usernames and think of Meg's post about Scotty and try again. CRO308 Survivor. I have been thinking very seriously about taking my life for several months now, but what's held me back is my mother. It's just her and me, and I worry about what it'll be like for her if I'm gone. Can I live with myself? Will I have to? This one also smells of bullshit. It's not entirely accurate to say Trisha didn't want me, because she did keep me. It's more that I don't think Trisha wanted children. What mother makes her two-year-old call her by her first name because she says she's too young to be called Mommy? I know Trisha would probably be pretty bummed if I killed myself, but I also know she's looking forward to having me out of her hair. She tells me this on a regular basis. I get a bunch of responses, some of them telling me that, yeah, it's a pretty fucked up thing to do to a single mom, that maybe I should wait for her to remarry or something. Which makes me laugh. Trisha can't remarry until she marries. And with her 3-month relationship shelf life, I can't see either of those ever happening. There's nothing from all underscore BS. I have this weird feeling that as long as I lie, I won't get a response. Which is kind of a catch-22. Because how can I do this without lying? I pick a new username. Something vaguely Meg-related. Repeat and repeat, but ambiguous enough not to be tied to her. Instead of trying to channel Meg, I try channeling myself. Repeat. The truth. I recently lost someone. Someone so integral to me, it's like a part of me is gone. And now I don't know how to be anymore. If there's even a me without her. It's like she was my son, and then my son went out. Imagine if the real son went out. Maybe there'd still be life on Earth. But would you still want to live here? Do I still want to live here? The next day, there are a bunch of responses, though not one from all_BS. Some of them are weird scientific explanations of how unlikely it is for the sun to actually go out. Others are more understanding of my loss. Others yet suggest that if I were to die, I'd be reunited with the person I lost. They're so certain, as if the final solution people have visited death, taken notes, and come back to report. I'm reminded that for so many of these people, this is a kind of entertainment. But I am starting to understand the appeal of the boards. Yesterday, when I hit post, I felt this massive sense of relief. This whole thing might be a charade, but for the first time in a long time, I am telling the truth. A few days later, I'm at work at the Thomases, trying to figure out how to smoke out all_BS. I'm lost in thought, which is maybe why I don't hear Mindy Thomas walk in while I'm cleaning her bedroom. If I had, I'd have gone and pretended to clean the garage or something. "Hey, Cody," Mindy calls in a sing-song voice. "How's it going?" "Great," I say with all the enthusiasm I can manage while holding a feather duster. Mindy is trailed by her posse, girls all a year younger than me whom I haven't seen much since I graduated. Sharon Devon waves to me. Sharon was one of Meg's acolytes. She adored her. Used to follow her around like Meg was a movie star. Meg pretended to be put out by this, but I knew she thought Sharon was sweet, particularly because she was nice to Scotty. She was his counselor at the Y camp, and he had a huge crush on her. "Hey, Cody," she says shyly. "Hi, Sharon. How's senior year going?" "Almost done. Any plans for after graduation?" "Sleep." "Yeah, I hear that. You know what?" Mindy interrupts, clapping her hands. "I have the best idea. Cody should come to the party. It's next weekend. My parents are going out of town, and it's going to be a rager." Before I have a chance to make an excuse, Mindy continues. "It'll be so perfect. You can come to the party and do the cleaning up afterwards." Her laughter follows her out of the room. I stand there, too floored to say anything. Mindy Thomas? We used to take dance class together. She always wore these perfect outfits. Leotards, leg warmers, ballet shoes. All matching. Trisha couldn't even afford the class. The teacher, a friend of hers, let me take it for free. So I just threw together what I could. Leggings that were ripped. A tank top. Mismatched leg warmers that I found at a thrift store. But then one day Mindy came in wearing the same getup as me. I'd thought she was making fun of me, but when I'd told Trisha, she'd laughed. "The little brat is copying you." I had my doubts. One thing I knew for sure. A year ago, Mindy Thomas never would have spoken to me like she just did. Sharon lingers after the other girls leave. "She's just being a bitch," she whispers. "You should come to the party." "Thanks, Sharon," I say. I hold up my feather duster to show her it's time to get back to work. She hesitates, as if she wants to tell me something else. But then Mindy calls to her and she trots off. Later, at the library, I can't stop thinking about Sharon, the way she used to idolize Meg. Meg may have stood out in town, but she definitely had her admirers. She had that thing. People, at least smart people, were drawn to her. People from school, musicians she met online, all_BS, they all found their way to Meg. How am I supposed to attract all_BS? I don't have what Meg had. People may have called us the pod, but it wasn't really an accurate description. There was Meg and me lassoing myself to her. I can't do that anymore. To find all_BS, I have to be all me. I take a breath and I start to type. Repeat. Repeat. I'm not one of those people who has spent a lot of time thinking about death, or imagining her own death, or dreaming of it, or wanting it. At least, I didn't think I was. But so much shit has happened in the last year of my life that I am questioning whether I even have a life, or if what I thought was my life is actually an illusion, or maybe a delusion. Because it doesn't seem like living to me. It seems like persevering. Like that's the most I can hope for. I'm not that old, but I'm already so tired. Even getting out of bed each morning seems like an enormous chore. Life seems to be about endurance, not enjoyment, not fulfillment. I don't see the point. If someone told me I could go back and undo my birth, I think I might. I really do. Is that the same as wanting to die? And if so, what does that mean? Chapter 23. One night, I'm sitting at my computer, staring at all of the messages I've posted to the final solution boards, and all the responses I've received. There are way too many pages to print out now without arousing Mrs. Banks' suspicion, so I've started saving everything to a file on the hard drive. The door swings open. I snap the computer shut. "Ever hear of knocking?" I ask Trisha. "When I'm living in your house, I'll consider knocking," she says. I'm about to mention that I pay rent and therefore it's my house too, but then I think of the box full of cash stashed under my bed and decide it's probably wiser if I don't bring money up. She taps on my computer, which is hot. "I read somewhere that the rise in cancer is linked to how much people stare at their computer screens all day," she says. "Everything gives you cancer," I reply. "The sun gives you cancer. I read that computers are really bad. All that radiation, it's not healthy." "Where'd you read that? In one of the many scientific journals you subscribe to?" She ignores the dig and sits down on the edge of my bed. "What are you reading these days?" "Me?" "Yeah, you. You used to always have your nose in a book, and now I only ever see you on that computer." When I returned the latest batch of books Mrs. Banks had borrowed for me, I pretended like I'd read them all when, in fact, I hadn't finished a single one. I used to read at home at night, but now I can't seem to stop looking at my growing file on Meg, which I've hidden in a dummy folder named College. I've still gotten no response from all_BS, and I keep rereading all the messages, trying to figure out what to do next. Trisha gestures to the computer. "What's so interesting in there, anyway? Is there some other world?" "It's not another world. It's just ones and zeros. That's all programming is." "But that's not true. All_BS is somewhere in there. Meg, too." Trisha doesn't say anything. She stares at my room, my walls, the pictures tacked up with scotch tape of me and Meg at shows, me and the Garcias on a camping trip to Mount St. Helens, Meg and me on graduation day last year, her beaming, me smirking. There are pictures of me and Trisha, too, but they're outnumbered by the Garcias. "You two always were like day and night," Trisha says, looking at the graduation picture. "We don't look that different." "Or didn't." Meg had dark brown eyes, and mine are hazel gray. But that was the biggest distinction. We both had brown hair, and though Meg had Joe's coffee complexion, in summer, my olive skin gets so dark that we used to say that I could pass for Joe's daughter. Except I wasn't Joe's daughter. And now this insistence on our resemblance embarrasses me. Was this just another way of trying to lasso myself to Meg? "I'm not talking about looks," Trisha replies. "Personality. You're nothing like her." I don't answer. "Thank God," Trisha adds. That's not a very nice thing to say. Trisha continues to stare at the graduation photo. She had everything. Those big brains, fancy college scholarship. She even had that expensive computer you can't seem to get off of. Then she looks back at me. You just had me. And you're smart, don't get me wrong. But you aren't Meg smart. You got stuck at the shitty junior college, and now, from what I can tell, you don't even have that. I twist a loose thread from my quilt around my finger until my finger throbs. Thank you, Trisha, for such a precise overview of my inferiority. But even with the deck stacked against you, you stuck to your guns. Trisha continues on her tear. You didn't quit that damn dance class that Tawny Phillips let you join for free, even when you sprained your ankle. I couldn't quit. I had the big solo in the dance show, all that jazz, I remind her. I'd forgotten about that. Mindy Thomas had been so pissed when I'd gotten the coveted role. I'm not sure Trisha remembers it either. She couldn't come to the show. She had to work. The Garcias came. Right, Trisha continues. And at school you hated math, but you kept with it, all the way through goddamn trignastics. Trigonometry, I correct. She waves away the distinction. You took math all the way through that, because you wanted to go to college. My point is, you never quit on dance, on math, on anything. And maybe you had more reason to. You had a pile of rocks, and you cleaned them up pretty and made a necklace. Meg got jewels, and she hung herself with them. I know I should defend Meg. This is my best friend, and Trisha has it wrong. She doesn't know the whole story, and she's probably jealous of the Garcias for being the family she never was. But I don't defend Meg. I may not be Joe's daughter, but right at this moment, I actually feel like Trisha's. Chapter 24. The next day, there is a message from all_BS. It simply says, "Who did you lose?" It takes me a minute to realize he, by this point, I'm almost certain he's a man, is referring to an older post, which means he's been watching me. I spend an hour thinking about what to write, which story will be most effective, and then I circle back. The true one will. Repeat. The better half of me? Within 20 minutes, he has responded again. all_BS. Nothing is more desirable than to be released from an affliction. But nothing is more frightening than to be divested of a crutch. James Baldwin. Repeat. What do you mean by this? The library closes before he has time to respond, leaving me to think about the quote all night. I bring my computer with me to the Chandlers the next morning and discover they don't lock their Wi-Fi network. I sneak into the bathroom and check to see if there's a response from all_BS. And there is. all_BS. Perhaps your better half, as you call it, was nothing more than a crutch. It can be terrifying after so long using one to go without. Maybe that adjustment is what you're going through now. And that's it. Nothing about offing myself, or life being the affliction. Only the suggestion that Meg was my crutch. The scary thing is, he's right. Meg held me up, and without her, I'm falling down. Repeat. So you're saying this is temporary? That I shouldn't be thinking about catching the bus because I'm just upset over my loss? I hear Mrs. Chandler in the next room. I quickly hit post and stash my computer in a corner. The rest of the morning I worry that I somehow put him off. I practically run to the library that afternoon, relieved to find a response waiting. all_BS. I'm saying no such thing. Repeat. Then what are you saying? He must still be online, because the reply is instant. All_BS.
What are you saying?
I think hard before I answer. Repeat. I don't know what I'm saying. I don't know what I'm doing. It's why I'm asking you. All_BS.
Yes. That is why you're asking me.
Chapter 25. In the middle of June, I get a call from Alice. I haven't spoken to her since the last time I stayed with her, but when I answer the phone, she starts burbling away like we chat every day. So I checked on the map, and you're in Eastern Washington, right? She asks after she's caught me up on things I don't really care about. Between Spokane and Yakima? There are hundreds of miles between Spokane and Yakima. I love how people consider it flyover. But I don't correct her. More or less. Cool! I'm working as a counselor at Mountain Bound. I'll be outside of Missoula, and I'm pretty sure I-90 goes through your neck of the woods.
It's not far from here.
Perfect! It's like 7 hours from Eugene to Spokane, or wherever you are. A good one-day drive, and then I can make it to Missoula the next day.
It takes me a second to understand what she's talking about. You want to stay with me?
If that's all right, she says.
We almost never have guests. Even Meg only slept here a handful of times. I'm already trying to figure out how to explain Alice to Tricia. Where to put her.
Tricia and Raymond still seem to be together, judging by the number of nights she hasn't been home.
Maybe she'll stay at his place that night. Though, if I request that, it's a surefire way to make sure it doesn't happen.
When are you coming?
Day after tomorrow. Give me your address.
And so I don't have a choice.
That night, I casually tell Tricia that someone is staying over.
Your boyfriend? She accuses.
There is no boyfriend, I say.
Then I think of Ben. And then I get mad at myself for thinking of Ben. And then I justify thinking of Ben because he was the object of her interrogation the last time this subject came up.
Then who is it you're talking on the computer with?
I'm not talking to anyone. I can't, because we don't have internet access.
Ha! But you won it! And now you're blushing. You're hiding something.
This time, she's right. But not about a boyfriend.
All_BS and I recently moved our conversation off the message boards and onto an anonymous communication software. And now we talk frequently. Our conversations, however, are frustratingly limited by library hours. They are also frustratingly not about suicide. At least not specifically. We speak in generalities, and sometimes I forget who I'm chatting with. Last week, I mentioned that I had a cold coming on, and he sent a recipe for a tea made of ginger and apple juice. When it worked, I made a crack about the irony of him curing my cold. Nice to know someone cares, I wrote. When he asked me what I meant by that, I started typing a message about Tricia, until I realized what I was doing and deleted it. I had to be more careful, not answer his messages spontaneously, or I'd screw up. So now, when I'm at the library, I save his messages to my Meg file, and when I'm at home, I write my responses, sending them the next time I'm online. It's a frustrating and clunky system, but the delay forces caution. The person staying over is Alice, I tell Tricia. I met her in Tacoma. She needs a place to crash on her way to Montana.
There. The truth.
Or a sliver of it. One of the things I've learned from dealing with all_BS is that if you hew close to the truth, it's much easier to lie.
Hasn't she ever heard of a motel? Tricia asks.
I'll take the couch. She can have my room.
Tricia sighs. No, you can take my bed. I'll stay at Raymond's.
I nod, as if the idea never occurred to me. The next night, at precisely 6 o'clock, Alice arrives, tooting her horn as she comes down the street like she's the marshal of a July 4th parade.
Some of the neighbors come out to see what the commotion is, and Alice waves to them, grinning.
"So, this is where you live?" she says.
I nod.
"It's not what I expected. It's so small."
She stops.
"Not your house. Your house is big. I mean the town."
My house is a cinder block cell with two tiny bedrooms. Small would be a step up. Now she's flustered.
"I didn't mean it like that. It's just, you seem so streetwise. I'd have thought you grew up somewhere else."
"Nope. This is me." We go inside. I show Alice to my room. I've put clean sheets on the bed for her. She flops back onto it, taking in the band flyers on my wall, all the pictures of me and Meg.
"So this is where Meg grew up, too?"
I nod again.
"How long did you guys know each other?"
"A long time." There's a picture of the two of us at a rodeo, maybe from fifth grade, the bucktooth phase.
"Is that you?"
Alice asks, leaning in. I should take all this down.
"Yep. You must have a lot of history here."
I think of the Dairy Queen, the rocket ship, the Garcia's house. "Not really," I say. We're silent for a while. Then Alice announces she's taking me out to dinner.
"No arguments."
"All right. Where do you want to go?"
"What are our options?"
"Your usual fast food. A bar and grill where my mother works. But trust me, you don't want to go there. A diner. A couple of Mexican places."
"Is the Mexican any good?"
Joe always said that Sue's cooking was better than his mother's, and much better than any of the places in town. We almost never went to them.
"Not particularly."
"I passed a Dairy Queen on the way in. We could go there." I picture the DQ, Tammy Hentoff, the usual suspects hanging out. "Let's do Mexican," I say. We head over to Casa Mexicana, full of red booths and velvet paintings of bullfighters. Our waiter is this guy, Bill, whom Trisha used to hang out with, which is how it always is in Shitburg. We order our food, and then Alice asks for a strawberry margarita with a shot of tequila. Bill cards her, and she hands over an ID.
"And a virgin for you, Cody?"
Bill asks with a smirk. I hate this town. I can't even order a meal without it feeling loaded. "Just a Dr. Pepper." "Are you 21? I ask Alice when Bill leaves.
"No, but Priscilla Watkins is."
She hands over her fake ID. I'm impressed. I didn't think Alice had it in her. As we wait for our drinks, the Thomas family comes in. Mrs. Thomas sort of waves. Mindy, who seems to be arguing with her sister over a hair straightening iron, ignores me. I shake my head.
"What?"
Alice asks. "How do you explain Shitburg to someone who describes her hometown as Eden?" Bill returns with the drinks. As soon as he's gone, I grab Alice's shot and down it. "Order another one." We keep drinking. Alice grows maudlin. She starts talking about Meg, loudly, how she wishes she could have known her better, how glad she is that she knows me. Somewhere it registers that she is saying nice things, but Mindy Thomas is two booths over, and I want Alice to shut up. When the food comes, Alice starts shoveling it into her mouth.
"Oh, yum! This is so good. We have, like, no good Mexican in Eugene."
"Hmm," I say, forking a mass of cheese off the enchilada. It peels away like skin after a sunburn. I push it to the side and try the rice.
"So, have you talked to Ben McAllister?"
Alice asks out of the blue. It's a dark restaurant, so she can't see my face go red.
"No." "Not at all?"
"Why would I?"
"I don't know. You two seemed like you had a spark."
"A mighty flame followeth a tiny spark." When we first started talking, all underscore BS quoted that to me. Dante, he said it was. I think he was trying to explain how simple musings could lead to big, life-changing ideas. His way of encouraging me. And I had to remind myself not to be reassured by it, because the life-changing idea he was selling me on was life-ending. No spark, I say. I push my plate away. That's probably good.
Why?
I hear the challenge in my voice. For one, Meg was totally gaga over him. I thought you claimed you didn't know her at all.
I didn't.
But she talked about Ben, and invited us to come to his band's gigs. So she must have been. Her inviting you to a gig wasn't Meg being into Ben. It was Meg being Meg. She doesn't say anything for a while, just slurps to the bottom of her drink.
Oh, that reminds me. Did you ever find the person Meg confided in about taking antidepressants?
Nope.
I might know who it is.
You think? I don't care anymore, because the point of finding that person was to find all underscore BS, and I already did that.
I'm not positive, but I think it's Tree.
Tree? Right.
I think it was, Alice says, sounding wounded.
You obviously don't know shit about Meg.
I believe we've established that, Alice says defensively. I still think it's her.
No. Meg would have hated Tree, and Tree didn't seem that charmed by Meg.
Not her, I mumble.
I'm suddenly tired, and my limbs no longer feel as if they are totally in my control. I remember belatedly why I don't like to be drunk.
Okay, 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 Alice says, waving her hands.
But she said something that made me think it. I can't remember now. But you should call her. The next morning, Alice gets ready to leave for her wonderful summer of adventure, and I get ready to clean toilets. I am hungover in a way that has less to do with the tequila I drank than with what it brought out in me. Why wasn't I nicer to Alice? When she has been nothing but sweet to me. When I actually like her. I know I should say something to her, but before I can find the words, she's tooting her horn and disappearing down the street. I wave until she turns the corner, and as I watch another person drive out of here to some better place, I understand exactly why I wasn't nicer. The Perdues are on vacation, so the day after Alice leaves, I have a day off. I head straight to the library, earlier than usual. The comforting hush of the place has been overtaken by the laughter and yelps of little kids. It's story time. On my way to the tables in the back, I spot Alexis Bray in the story circle, holding hands with her little daughter. I can't remember the girl's name, even though she came with Alexis to almost all of Meg's services, sitting quietly on her mother's lap. At one of the receptions, Alexis asked me if I wanted to go for coffee. I said I'd call her, but I never did. I wasn't sure why she wanted to meet in the first place. She was 4 years ahead of Meg and me, and I didn't know much about her except that she used to go out with Jeremy Driggs, though he wasn't the father of her little girl. Apparently it was some guy in the army. She waves at me now. As does Mrs. Banks, who gestures for me to sit in one of the carrels off to the side, where it's quieter. Although not much. Story time is a pretty raucous affair. The assistant librarian is reading some story about a bunny that keeps telling its mother all the ways it's going to run away, even though, obviously, if the rabbit meant business, it would not be telling its mother. When you're serious, you keep quiet. One of the little kids shambles away from the circle over to where I'm sitting. His diaper sags halfway down to his knees, and there's a big stain of what looks like peas, but could be something grosser, down the front of his car's shirt. I'm disgusted. Kids are like parasites. I suspect Trisha has had the same thought about me. I wonder if Meg did, too. The librarian moves on to a different book, Something about disappearing balloons, which sounds even more stupid. Which is maybe why my little foul-diapered friend shows no interest in returning to story time. He just stares at me with soupy eyes. I try to look away, but it's not easy when someone is staring at you. The effort not to look makes my stomach churn like the agitator of a washing machine. Churn, churn, churn. I see Alice in the mountains of Montana, surrounded by a bunch of other similarly chirpy people. Churn, churn, churn. I see Hendrik swallowing that mouse. Churn, churn, churn. I see Meg at her computer, typing her time-delayed suicide note. Churn, churn, churn. I see me at this very library, clicking open her suicide note. I regret to inform you. The little kid is still at my side, his grubby, sticky hands inches away from the keyboard. You really don't want to get any closer, I say, giving him my most menacing look, in case the threat in my voice wasn't clear enough. His chin crumples before he starts to cry. His mom hustles over, apologizing to me, which means she probably doesn't know what I said. But Alexis gives me a weird look, which means she probably does. So, this is who I've become. Someone who picks fights with toddlers. I return my attention to the computer, scrolling through all underscore BS's words. The tiny spark. The mighty flame. Screw your courage to the sticking place. The little kid is now sobbing from the safety of his mother's lap. I feel ashamed. But the shame has forced some clarity upon me. I can keep picking small fights, or brave the big one. Time to screw my courage, or go down trying. In quick succession, I send two messages. The first is to Harry Kang, asking him what kind of information I'd need to track someone down, because all this becoming all underscore BS's buddy does me no good, unless I can find out who he is. The second is to all underscore BS. I'm ready. I want to take the next steps. Will you help me? As soon as I hit send on the second message, my anger, my angst, my self-pity disappears, leaving only a calm and steely resolve. I wonder if this was how Meg felt. The little kid has stopped crying and is now staring at me resentfully with his tear-stained face. I look back at him and smile. Chapter 26. It doesn't take all underscore BS long to reply to my message, though he doesn't respond in the way I expected him to, by sending me the same files I believe he sent Meg. Instead, what I get is a message quoting Martin Luther King Jr. Faith is taking the first step, even when you can't see the whole staircase. To it, he adds, you've already taken the first step in deciding. After that comes a link leading to a sort of directory with all these options. Pills, poisoning, gunshot, asphyxiation, strangulation, drowning, carbon monoxide, jumping, hanging. When you click on each one, there is a detailed, and I mean detailed, list of pros and cons, as well as statistics listing success rates of each method. This is similar to the document I first found encrypted in Meg's trash, but not the same. Over the next week, more messages come. If you realize that all things change, there is nothing you will try to hold on to. If you are not afraid of dying, there is nothing you cannot achieve. Lao Tzu. Do you know what that means? Letting go of the fear? Dying is not about ending something. It's about beginning something. I keep thinking of the moniker you use. Repeat. It
It's not accidental, I assume. But you realize, repeating is precisely what you're doing. The same thing. It's only when you're willing to do something bold, different, that your life will truly change.
He's proud of me. I can tell. Which makes me proud of myself. I know it shouldn't, but it still does. I keep waiting for him to ask for specifics. I've spent hours looking at the suicide shopping list, so without intending to, I sort of planned how I might do it. Or rather, I planned myself doing it as Meg did, getting the fake business license, ordering the poison, having it delivered to one of those mailbox places, writing a will, packing up my room, going to the bank to get a $50 bill for the maid's tip, composing an email, setting it for delivery, checking into a motel. The information on the site's all underscore BS referred me to is so thorough that I know how it would feel to take the poison. The burning sensation in my throat, then my stomach. The tingling in my feet that would tell me it was starting to work. Then the cramps, followed by coldness, as the cyanosis kicked in. I've imagined it so many times now. First with Meg, then with me. And it's like how it always used to be, when I couldn't tell one of us from the other. When I didn't want to. So I want him to ask me if I've thought of a method, because if he did, I'd be able to tell him. And I think he'd be pleased. But he doesn't ask, so I just keep planning. One afternoon, I'm getting ready to shower after work. I'm rooting through the medicine cabinet for a new razor when I see one of those massive bottles of Tylenol that Trisha buys from the warehouse store. I know from my research that Tylenol is a terrible, horribly painful but inexpensive way to do it. I turn off the shower. I go into my room. I pour the white tablets onto my bedspread. How many would I take? How many could I swallow at once? How would I keep from throwing them up? Staring at the pills, it seems so easy. Like something I could do. Right now. Swallow pills. Jump off a freeway overpass. Find someone's loaded gun. You don't want to die, I have to remind myself. But if you did, a little voice answers. Imagine how simple it would be. The doorbell rings, and I'm startled and red-faced with instant shame. I hastily put the pills back in the bottle and shove it into the medicine cabinet. The doorbell rings again. It's Scotty, holding Samson on a leash and kicking at some dried leaves that have bunched up under the mat. He looks at me in my rumpled, sour-smelling T-shirt. "Are you sleeping?" he asks. "No. I haven't been sleeping much lately." Which makes me look as if I've always just been woken up. I'm still a little shaken by the Tylenol, so when Scotty asks me if I want to go for a walk with him and Samson, I almost leap out the door. We set off into the dusky late afternoon. I'm hyper now, a one-woman small-talk machine. I ask Scotty about school, only to have him remind me it's summer break. I ask him what he's doing this summer, and he reminds me that he's at the Y camp. I should know this because it's what he does every summer, as did Meg when she was younger. I used to beg Trisha to sign me up too, but she said she refused to spend money on camp when she was free during the day, so summers meant me counting the hours until the Garcias got home. Scotty keeps walking, and I keep asking inane questions, and when I run out of those, I'm about to ask if he's got any good knock-knock jokes. He and Meg used to make up the most absurd, nonsensical ones. Knock-knock. Who's there? Lie. Lie who? Lions lie. And they'd laugh and laugh until someone cried or farted. When I'd shake my head and call them gross, they'd say I lacked their stupid humor gene, which I knew was them being silly, but made me feel bad somehow. So I don't ask for jokes. and then I run out of small talk. By this point, we've looped through town and Samson has taken two shits, which Scotty has stoically scooped into plastic bags. "Are you looking?" he asks. "Am I looking?" I repeat.
"For the person from the note who helped her."
I don't know why I'm so surprised that he knows this. He's the one who knew it all along. My expression must give something away, because he nods slightly, like he understands.
"Good," he says.
At the corner of his street, Scotty lets Samson off his leash.
"Get him,"
he says. I think he's talking to the dog, but I realize he's talking to me. When I get home, I take the Tylenol out of the medicine cabinet, dump the pills down the toilet, and bury the bottle in the garbage. A few days later, when Trisha gets her period and goes crazy trying to find the bottle, I play dumb. Chapter 27. The next time I go to the library, the front door is locked, which is weird. I know the opening hours by heart. Closed Sunday and Mondays. Open Tuesdays from 1 to 6. I check my phone. Tuesday, 3:30. I give the doors a shake and then, frustrated, a kick. I come back the next day when the library should be open all day, but it's the same thing. Mrs. Banks is inside, though. I knock on the door. "What's going on?" I ask her when she unlocks it. "There was a small electrical fire over the weekend," she tells me. "We have to rewire, and there's no electricity in the building until then. We've been warning them about the wiring for years." She shakes her head and sighs. "Budget cuts." "What am I supposed to do?" I cry. The library has become my lifeline, my conduit to all underscore BS. It's already been 4 days since we last communicated, and I'm strung out. Mrs. Banks smiles. "Don't worry, I've thought of that." She goes back inside and returns with a shopping bag full of books. "You can keep them until we reopen. Shouldn't be longer than a week or two." "These are off the grid, so to speak," she says with a wink. "So we're on the honor system. But I trust you." The next time I have internet access is Friday at Mrs. Chandler's, but she's there, so there's no sneaking the signal. I'm desperate to hear from all underscore BS, desperate enough to explain to Mrs. Chandler about the library fire and ask if I can stay after work to check my email using her Wi-Fi connection. Mrs. Chandler looks at me a long time.
"You don't have internet at your house?"
she asks. I shake my head, embarrassed.
"Of course," she says. "Use it any time."
I'm itchy and anxious when I log on. What if all underscore BS has lost interest? But then I see the number of unread messages from him. The silence has worked in my favor. Used to hearing from me almost every day, except Sundays and Mondays, all underscore BS is clearly worried that I haven't responded to his messages in nearly a week. The tone of his messages is one of increasing concern. I can't quite tell if he's worried that I offed myself without telling him, or that I changed my mind. Trisha always says that guys want you more when they think they can't have you. I reassure him that it's just internet access issues. And then I think of Mrs. Chandler's concerned face, and I get an idea. "I don't think I'll have regular access to internet again for a while," I write, playing up the library's electrical problems. "And I don't know how I'll do this without your help. I already chose my route, but if I don't catch the bus soon, I might miss it. Is there any other way we can communicate? Like on the phone?" It feels like it takes an hour for his response to arrive, though it only takes 5 minutes.
"That's not wise," he writes back.
I force myself to wait 10 minutes before replying. "I don't see any other way," I write. And then I type my cell phone number. "Call if you can." I hear nothing, and without internet, we can't have our email communication either. I am disgusted to admit it to myself, but I miss the back and forth. which really means I miss him. Work is tedious. No matter how much I scrub and polish, the houses still seem dingy to me. One morning I arrive at the Purdue's and see Mr. Purdue's car in the driveway, and I want to run away. But where is there to go? I steel myself and open the door with the key Mrs. Purdue hides for me under the fake rock. I'm in the kitchen, digging out the cleaning supplies from under the sink when Mr. Purdue breezes in.
I took a sick day, he informs me, answering a question I didn't ask.
Hope you feel better.
Oh, I'm fine. It's more of a mental health day.
I don't answer as I head to the bathroom. I shut the door, even though that means the fumes will be stronger. I'm leaning over the tub with a can of Clorox when I hear the door open behind me. The Purdue's have two bathrooms. There is no need for him to use this one. I wait for him to turn around, but he doesn't. He comes closer. He's barefoot, and I can hear the sound of his toes cracking against the tile floor. I stand up and turn around, the Clorox can still in my hand, my finger still on the nozzle. He takes a step toward me. The distance between us is already unnecessarily close, and then he takes another step. I hold the can to his face and squeeze out a tiny warning shot. Just give me a reason, I say. Just one. I mean to be tough, but to my ears it sounds almost pleading. He backs out of the bathroom, arms up in surrender. By the time I hear the tires squeal out of the driveway, my rage has passed. But unlike the last time he messed with me, I am not at all triumphant or Buffy-like. I already warned him once, but he just paid me 10 more bucks and came back for more. It's a bleak night. Trisha is out with Raymond, and the neighbors next door are having a party. I still smell of bleach, even after my shower. And it's like it's not the bleach, but Mr. Purdue's lechery that won't wash off. I can't face looking at Final Solution notes, so I try to force myself to do something different. I leaf through a couple of library books, but the words swim on the page. I open Meg's computer for a game of solitaire, but I wind up in her email program again. For the 100th time, I stare at the missing hole of mail, as if the deleted messages might magically materialize and answer all my questions. I back up and read the notes she wrote to Ben. I read what he wrote back. You have to leave me alone. How that had pissed me off. Only it's hard to summon the anger now. Because hadn't I told her the same thing? Just without words? Was she mad at me? For being too close? For pulling away? For not coming to Oregon over Christmas break? I pull up the email she wrote me after I broke our weeks of silence by telling her about Mr. Purdue's first ass grab.
Ha! That skeevy old bastard! How I wish I could have seen that! I know you'll always be strong. You'll always be my Buffy, she wrote.
I take out my phone. Ben's texts are still in the log, ending abruptly after I told him to stay away. My finger lingers over the call button. I imagine talking to him, telling him about Mr. Purdue today, telling him everything that's been going on the past few weeks. It's only when I hear the first ring that I realize I've actually hit call. When I hear the second ring, I remember how often his phone rang when we were sitting there watching TV together that day. I picture my call being the one that interrupts his time with some girl now. And with a sudden and abrupt disgust, I see that I've let myself become that girl. Before the third ring, I've hung up. Also in my text log is a message from Alice with Tree's number.
Call her, Alice exhorted.
I haven't, because the whole point of finding the mystery friend was to find all underscore BS. But right now, Tree's caustic bitterness seems to fit the mood. The world's grumpiest peace-and-love hippie answers.
What?
Is this Tree? I ask, even though I can tell it is.
Who wants to know?
It's Cody. I pause. Meg's friend?
There's silence on the line, not a friendly one. She's not going to speak, so I continue.
So, I saw Alice a few weeks ago.
Congratulations. Good old tree. At least she's consistent.
She mentioned that Meg might have confided in you about going on antidepressants or something, I say.
Confided in me?
There's something between a laugh and a bark.
Why would she do that? We didn't exactly do each other's nails.
It's such a bizarre image that I almost smile. It didn't seem likely, but Alice mentioned you having said something. She couldn't remember what.
She never confided in me. But someone should have force-fed her a whole bottle of antidepressants. She so obviously needed them.
The almost smile dies. What are you talking about?
I've never met anyone who spent so much time in bed. Except for my mom when she's having a depressive episode.
Your mom?
She's bipolar. I don't know if Meg was. I never saw her manic, but I saw her depressed. Trust me, I know what that looks like.
I'm about to tell Tree about the mono, how tired Meg had sometimes gotten since then, how if she slept enough for 5 people, it was because she expended the energy of 10 people. She needs a little time to rejuvenate, Sue would sometimes say, closing the door, sending me away. Then Tree says, plus, healthy people don't talk that way about suicide. The hair on the back of my neck rises.
What? We had a feminist lit class together, and one night me and her and a few other girls were in a cafe, studying at a table, and Meg starts quizzing everyone about how they'd off themselves. We were reading Virginia Woolf, and at first I thought it was because of that. Everyone had their half-baked answers, guns or pills or jumping off a bridge. But not Meg. She was very specific. I'd take poison, and I'd do it in a hotel room, and I'd leave the maid a big tip.
Neither of us says anything. Because, of course, that's exactly what Meg did do.
At which point, I told her that she should stop moping and get to the campus health center for some Prozac already.
A friend told me to go to the campus health center to get some meds.
It was you, I whisper into the phone. I can hear her surprise crackle through the phone. Me?
She said a friend talked her into going to the campus health center, and I've talked to dozens of people, and no one ever mentioned a thing. No one thought to suggest it. Except you.
We weren't friends.
Well, we were. We were best friends. And not only did I not suggest this, I didn't think to.
Then we both failed her,
Tree says. And there's such anger in her voice. And it's then I get it. The animosity. It's Meg. It's the tentacles of her suicide, reaching out, burning people who barely knew her.
Sorry, Tree mutters under her breath.
She listened to you. She went to the campus health center and got some meds.
So what happened? Tree asks. Didn't they work?
It's my understanding that you have to take them for them to work.
She didn't take them?
Someone talked her out of it.
Why would they do that? Those drugs saved my mom's life.
I think of all the stuff on the boards, about the drugs numbing your soul. But that wasn't it. It was because someone convinced Meg that her life wasn't worth saving, that death was a better option. It was because at the very end, when it should have been me whispering in her ear, telling her how amazing she was, how amazing her life was and would be again, it was all underscore BS doing the whispering. Tree is right about failing Meg. But it wasn't her that did. It was me. I failed her in life. But I won't fail her in death.
Chapter 28